Welcome back to Reading Orwell, after a little bit of a hiatus. This episode is another interview, here with Professor John Bowen, who teaches at the University of York. John is known primarily as a scholar of Charles Dickens, but he was recently given the opportunity to edit the Oxford World's Classics edition of Orwell's 1984, something that shouldn't be all that surprising, given Orwell's interest in and admiration for Dickens, and the often Dickensian flavour of his writing. I spoke with John about the edition, about the Orwell-Dickens connection, and about the links between 1984 and the present moment. The episode was recorded back in one of the COVID-19 lockdowns, so without further ado, let's listen to the conversation. I think I'm right in saying that you're not known as an Orwell scholar, but you might want to correct me in this. But I mean, have you been reading Orwell for long? And, you know, depending on what you say, what took you there first?
Yes, it's true. I mean, I mainly work on 19th century fiction, although I do some on the work. I'm interested in the kind of interwar period, people like Pole, Anthony Pole, and Evelyn Waugh, and Orwell. Yeah, I've been reading. I mean, I read Orwell when 1984 was a book about the future. So in the 1970s when I was at school, and, you know, like lots of people, I kind of fell in love with it. You know, it was about big issues. You know, you could identify with him. He seemed to have a kind of political urgency, all that sort of stuff that as a teenager you find so attractive and appealing. And then, yeah, I've probably been reading him on and off ever since. You know, and that things have changed so much. You know, 1984 itself was an amazing year for kind of explosion of Orwell criticism. And also we've just learned so much more about him through a string of good biographies and through the most amazing edition, you know, by Peter Davison of all of his writing. So I think, you know, students now are in such a kind of stronger position really to understand what he's doing and to read widely in him and to see the biographical roots of it and also just to test it against a much longer kind of political experience. So I've had moments, you know, over the years of both being very drawn to Orwell and also kind of quite strongly rejecting or being very critical of him. And so when OUP asked me to do an edition, you know, I bit their hand off, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that you've had a kind of fluctuating relationship with the writer. And I wondered whether you mean, you know, both of these things at once or these things separately, whether you mean the writer or you mean the man, because I think that there are some interesting differences to be drawn there. Could you just say a bit more about that sense of, you know, you said that sometimes you were quite critical of him. Is that at the writing or the sort of the man behind the writing?
Well, it may even be more than two. I mean, it may be the politics and the writing and the biography. I mean, on the whole, I mean, I think, and also actually when you said the man, you know, a book I've found very interesting and helpful and provocative was Raymond Williams' book, The Modern Masters book on Orwell, where he makes a clear distinction between the persona of Orwell and the biographical person. And I think that's strong too. So I think I've had mixed feelings about his politics. I've had mixed feelings about the quality of his writing. And I've had mixed feelings about the persona as well. So I think probably on all of those, there's been a push and a pull. But sometimes the persona kind of man confronting experience in a straightforward, plain way. It seemed very attractive, particularly at first, but I became more and more sceptical about that. And I think I became more sceptical about his views about language and also about some of his political position taking. But what I think keeps drawing me back to it is the way that those are in play in some ways in the fiction in more complicated ways than they're often cashed out as being. By critics or by simple admirers or simple rejectors of Orwell. So I think that he's very interested in ambivalent emotional states, you know, 1984 is, and the ambivalence in a way, the complexity and the contradictions are what keeps drawing me back to the work, I think.
I'm reminded here of that essay collection, Inside the Myth, Christopher Norris edited in, I think it was in 1984, actually. And that really... I mean, it really mounted some very strong criticisms of Orwell and really sort of took to task that sort of empirical down-to-earth persona and writing style and epistemology that it presents and in some very sort of uncompromising ways. But readers keep coming back to Orwell, don't they? So there must be something there that sort of is so sort of self-evidently attractive to people, even if one might be critical of it. And that to me puts the editor in a really sort of intriguing position, that sense of distance on the one hand, but interest on the other. That can be quite useful, I think, for somebody who's actually trying to think textually about a writer. I want to ask you some questions related to this in a moment, but I just wondered, just for a few minutes, if we could just go back to your remark about Charles Dickens and your professional background in Dickens, a massive influence on Orwell and the subject of one of his best-known essays. Do you see connections between the two figures? Have you worked on them in that way?
The essay on Dickens, I mean, it's very interesting. It's a bit like many of the things I was just saying now about feeling both very drawn to it. He clearly loves Dickens and knows him, even rereading it relatively recently. It made me realise just how well he knew him, just how intimately Orwell knew seemingly all the novels and lots of backwaters and, you know, minor characters, and in a very engaged and affectionate way. As a novelist, he's very different himself, and particularly, I think, in his relationship to working people. So Dickens, he goes to work in the blacking warehouse when he's a 12-year-old boy, and his father goes to prison. So he knows the life of the poor and the indigent and the people just clinging on to gentility. Orwell, when he goes tramping and works as a dishwasher, knows it. But their whole stance towards that popular poor life is different, I think. There's much more disgust in Orwell, a kind of class disgust that I find, you know, difficult and sometimes repellent. The key claim, as it were, that Orwell makes in the essay on Dickens is that Dickens is at bottom a change of heart man, i.e. that really it's like here's Scrooge, he's being mean to everybody, and Dickens writes a story in which Scrooge learns to change his emotional relationship to the world. For Orwell, that's the kind of key to Dickens. And I think it's completely, completely wrong. And because it separates off what Dickens always wants to think together, as it were, you know, the people's complex emotions and affective states and lives with a rich understanding of social world and the powers that are at play within that social world and the way they inflict themselves upon people. So I think Orwell separates off two things that Dickens constantly wants to think together. And it kind of guts Dickens of his political radicalism. Which I think is very real, different from Orwell's, but there's no doubt it's real. So I love that essay, and it's full of good things about Dickens, but I do think that's a failure to think it through by Orwell.
What do you make of another claim that he makes in the essay, Orwell, writing about Dickens, that Dickens admires common decency, given how sort of thoroughly preoccupied with decency Orwell himself is?
Part of the Orwell myth or the Orwell persona will be that allegiance to common decency. Like he's a kind of just encountering the world in this and using ordinary language to understand how it is and that you value this implicitly shared value between all right-thinking people. And I'm pretty skeptical about that. It's too easily consensual, I think, in a way, and too uncritical of the way in which it kind of, I think decency probably collapses together properly kind of moral questions and other things like questions about your body, for example, or about your emotions. You know, the moment you start to think, well, is that a useful idea? You then have to say, well, what would be indecent for Orwell? And clearly what was thought indecent in the 1940s is very different from what we now think was indecent. So that's a very historically variable term, I think. And it's a very typical Orwell move. I think probably one that I'd want to be pretty sceptical about endorsing myself.
The problem with that term, as you say, is that it has the seeming attractiveness of precision and sort of commonly agreed upon standards. But actually, on closer inspection, once you read through, you know, all those volumes that you mentioned a moment ago, the Peter Davison, the complete works of Orwell, and you find this word again and again and again, the regularity with which that it's mentioned in the absence of any clear sense of what he means by it again and again and again, just completely complicates matters each and every time it comes into view. You know, you just start to lose the sense of there actually being anything there in the word at all, other than this sort of common sense thought.
you could imagine that inflected in racist ways. We have common decency, whereas they don't. Or we heterosexuals have common decency in the way we behave, whereas those sexual perverts don't. And we know that Orwell often does those things, both with racial others and with people that he disapproves of sexually or for whatever reason. So there's a claim that there's a to commonality there, which is very powerful in all his writing. But in fact, is often inflected, you know, or he'll say it about working class people, you know, that decency is clearly a way of separating off working people you might approve of, working people you don't. So it becomes, you know, I think, in uses like that, often quite pernicious.
It sort of too easily brings into view something that seems self-evidently there, but actually isn't, and is only there to be brought in the terms of prejudice, really. I mean, I like this remark that you're making about how it can be, you know, in terms of what's indecent, is often sort of latent within the idea of decency itself for Orwell. You know, the decent person behaves in such and such a way, but forget about all these others. And this is the part of Orwell that I find particularly difficult to deal with, which is that on the one hand, we have this very sort of radically imaginative person as a writer and as a thinker, who for me is extremely persuasive on many fronts, and yet is bound up with the worst kinds of prejudice on the other that seems always to accompany those same things. And I've been teaching an Orwell class, and we've been constantly brought up against this, you know, where we think that Orwell is sort of writing in a virtuous way, say in Burmese Days or in Homage to Catalonia, this then seems also to be accompanied and almost reliant upon a homophobic remark or a racist category that seems to sit beneath the very things that he's doing well or sort of is trying to do well. And that tension in his thought is what keeps it unsettling at all times, I think. And I wonder here then about, from the point of view of an editor, what exactly we're dealing with, because I was fascinated in looking at your edition of 1984 that you've just done for the Oxford World Classics series, that in your editorial introduction, you are very clear in showing the tensions, the paradoxes and the incongruities in relation to certain, it has to be said, not all that often sort of discussed modes of representation in Orwell. You know, you go to the Gothic and you go to homoeroticism, you know, to name just two of them. I mean, the Gothic was the element of this that really caught my attention. I was really interested by it. I think it's just extremely cleverly done. What sort of took you to the Gothic as an idea in relation to 1984?
Okay, one thing I think is that the secondary literature on 1984, you say you'll edit it, and then you start to see the scale of the secondary literature. It's just immense. And yet, and there are some honourable exceptions to this, my sense was just on the whole how poor the quality of reading of the novel was, so that very quickly people would start to talk about contemporary politics or about history, or they would not spend that much time being attentive to the kind of things that literary critics are interested in, like its formal, narrative, literary kinds of qualities. And they'd often pass through that. So, you know, there's a Penguin edition from a few years ago in which the introduction says, Ben Pimlet says, this is one of the great novels of all time. And then he immediately says, most of the characters are stereotypes and cutouts. You kind of think, what's going on there then? Right? How can it be such a great novel if the literary expression and the characterization aren't very good? And so I wanted to just try to think that through, because on the one hand, quite a lot of literary critics don't think Orwell, as it were, in terms of the quality of his prose, is all that high. On the other hand, clearly a very, very important novel is 1984, so I wanted to think that through. There were several things in the book that once you start to notice them, you see just how pervasive they are, and that on the whole had very rarely, I think, been discussed in the secondary criticism. So, for example, this very strange relationship between Winston and O'Brien. For 7 years, they've been watching him like a beetle, even though he's a very unimportant member of the outer party. Why should they be doing that? Why does he have such incredibly powerful feelings about O'Brien, kind of wants to throw himself in front of him, do anything he asks him to. O'Brien, who's the kind of torturer and a member of the party. So there's a kind of, there are scenes where they seem to have a telepathic understanding with each other. He thinks of himself as being like a monster, does Winston. So all these stuff look pretty clearly like markers of the Gothic, right? A world in which people are in prison, they don't have freedom, in which paranoia is the dominant emotion, which they're separated off from something important to them, like the past or their family that they can never quite attain. These are all the absolutely characteristic marks of Gothic fiction. In a way, what you want to say about a book is something that's so clearly there, and yet nobody's noticed it. So people go, God, I must be asleep. How is that? It's so bloody obvious there. And that's that. And you don't often get those moments as a critic, in which you're not having to do anything very elaborate or recherche, but you just start noticing textual features. And there were just lots and lots and lots of tropes from Gothic and emotions. So you think, what the dominant Gothic emotions? They're horror and terror. This is a book full of horror and terror. It hasn't got a Gothic castle exactly, but my God, what else is the Ministry of Love? You know, the way it's defended by all these guards, and it's got machine guns around it, and it's got cellars. I had been working a bit on the Gothic beforehand, but you don't even need to know a huge amount about the Gothic to just see how deeply pervasive it is.
Prior to reading your introduction, I was one of those people who was just not seeing that, even though it's there, you know, now, and it seems so obviously there after having read your words. I'd often found myself being preoccupied with all of the animal metaphors and animal comparisons in it. And it had this weird feeling of somehow being a novel that had kind of fallen out of the back end of Animal Farm, as it were, or was kind of left over from Animal Farm. I wondered, actually, just in relation to the Gothic, whether you see it inhabiting the Gothic kind of on its own terms, or if you see a longer Gothic strain in Orwell. Is that there, do you think?
Yes, I do. I mean, just on the animal thing, I mean, it's partly that one of the things that is always at stake in the Gothic is the human. And so that it's, and that the human is never, as it were, taken for granted, that you know what a human is. And so there's a constant possibility within lots of Gothic texts of the human becoming either mechanical or animal, ghostly or spectral in some way. And he thinks of himself as all monstrous, and he thinks of himself as a ghost or a monster at times. There's a bit where the moment when the picture falls off the wall and they're caught by in their little secret hideaway, Julia and Winston are caught by the thought police. They all start to say the same lines over and over again, like there's something machine-like or automatic. So the animal stuff, I think, is part of the way in which the human, the very status of being human, is vulnerable in the book. Yeah, and I do think it's part of a longer thing in Orwell. I mean, so that his childhood sweetheart, Jacinta Buddicombe, says how much he loved reading Gothic texts. You know, his housemaster, I think, at Eton was M.R. James, the great writer of Gothics, so of Gothic stories. So, yeah, I think that threads there quite a way back. But the other thing I'd just say on the Gothic front is it's not just Gothic, I think. It's a particular kind of paranoid Gothic, which is a particular structure of male desire. So that Eve Sedgwick, you know, the kind of founder of queer theory, her first book is on the Gothic. And she's very interested in these structures in which there's a triangular relationship between a rivalry between two men for a woman. But really the great bond is between the two men in the novel. So Frankenstein is like that, or Edwin Drood by Dickens is. And here too, the relationship with Julia, in one way, Orwell isn't very good at portraying women. It's often very misogynistic. Whereas the real passion of the book is his relationship to O'Brien. And part of the kind of great breakthrough of intimacy with O'Brien is when he says, do it to Julia. So often, Orwell's sexuality is often separated off as being about his own eroticism or his own same-sex desire. But what Sedgwick points to is this structure within late 19th and 20th century masculinity, men on the one hand being forced together in homosocial ways, be with other men, work with other men in the Burma police or in Eton or wherever it might be, but not in that way. Not in a sexual way. And that generates what she calls homosexual panic, which can often be violent, misogynistic, and paranoid. And that's very much the affective shape or the emotional timbre of this novel. And that's what generates these kind of paranoid gothic plots. It's a particular structure of male desire, and Orwell is absolutely archetypal. So that's also the tradition, the particular gothic tradition that comes out.
That's really fascinating, this, because it's, I'm wondering all the time as you're talking about how the editor as a figure, so you, the editor of this novel, handle the text then, because unlike his, say, I don't know, if you go from Burmese Days, Clergyman's Daughter, Keep the Aspidistra Flying, Coming Up for Air, so if you stick with those novels, they're all full of allusions to contemporary events and figures and sort of real world things that the reader sort of new to or unfamiliar with Orwell might need assistance with. One of the great sort of defining features of 1984 and Animal Farm to a certain extent is that you can come to it without that baggage or without that needing to be there to some extent, because it is more fantastical. It's rooted more in the imagination than, say, a work like A Clergyman's Daughter, which is very much of its time. 1984, as we all know, is often said to be timeless and sort of applicable to any time. You were reading 1984 as a reader, as a critic, but you were also reading it as an annotator and an explainer. How did you handle these different sides of the book in providing explanatory notes to it? What were your goals in doing that?
You want the reader to understand the book, but you don't to keep stepping in between the reader and the text, so that you don't want to keep sending them to a footnote that's unnecessary or fussy. So on the whole, I think footnotes should be supply factual information that will help the reader, and readers are very varied, of course, but help the reader to understand what the text is doing. The interpretive stuff and the biographical stuff, I think that should go in the introduction usually or in the further reading. So some editions, there have been some annotated editions of 1984 before. There's one by Bernard Crick that I think is just rather eccentric, really. It's very heavily annotated. And so, for example, there's a bit where someone gets sent to Ministry of Love because he used the word God in a translation of a poem by Kipling into Newspeak. And he said that the previous word was rod. Now, it's quite useful, I think, to put a footnote in there saying what the poem by Kipling is. But Bernard Crick doesn't tell us what the poem is. But it does say, I think rod is clearly a phallic symbol. Now, that seems to be not what footnotes should do, because that's an interpretive matter. So that's the kind of material that should go in an introduction. What the reader wants is the identification of the particular poem, I think. So on the whole, they should be factual, I think, not interpretive, and not, there's some where I draw out some biographical links, but I didn't want to overdo that, because that then pushes the reader to thinking that it's simply an expression of Orwell's biography rather than a complex work of art in itself. That's one thing I wanted to avoid, I think. And I made some parallels with other of Orwell's writing. So when, the 2 + 2 = 5, he uses in some journalism before using 1984. So it's important the reader knows things like that as well. So some parallels with his earlier writing, and then some historical material from, particularly from the 1940s, that's useful to know when the first atomic bomb was exploded, just to get a sense of the generating context of the novel.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Kipling. You've also, in your explanatory notes, drawn out connections with T.S. Eliot, for example, haven't you? Who stands behind 1984, as it were, not only in terms of the emphases of the text, but also biographically for Orwell. I mean, I have to say, I'm impressed with the restraint that you show here, because I think one of the things that 1984 does is sort of recapitulate some of the recurrent patterning in Orwell's writing, and gives it its sort of, not that he knew it necessarily at the time, but its sort of defining emphasis. So there are even just turns of phrase that crop up way back in Down and Out, Paris and London, that recur here, and many preoccupations that go through the oeuvre, as a whole, sort of things to do with disgust, feelings of paranoia, as you say, that seem to be present in all of the work sort of building up to it. And it's, if you're an Orwell kind of fan or an Orwell enthusiast, it can be hard to resist wanting to sort of point out all the different ways in which that takes shape across the different novels.
It's difficult getting the balance right, I think. I think I was always trying to think of a new reader and not wanting to get between them and the text in a way. And the great thing now is that Orwell, of course, is out of copyright. So there'll be lots of annotated, or there's a potential for lots of annotated editions of Orwell. I guess for me, those would be more interpretive. And so they go in an article or an introduction or something, rather than, I guess I just think, as a reader, I don't want too often to be pulled back to look at the back of the book and then come back to the text. But sometimes I really need to know a fact or a piece of information in order to understand it. And those are the ones I think that I've always tried to do. But it's very, like, I've done a few of these now. So for Penguin and for World's Classics. And when you talk to people about what they want in footnotes, they radically differ. So some people want everything footnoted and some people want as few footnotes as possible. And even talking to colleagues, you know, people who are professional, you know, academics in literary departments, some will say, oh, I read every footnote. And some people say, I never look at footnotes. So people really differ on it. And I think on the whole, it's one of those things, like, I don't think there's any rules for it, really, in a way. It's kind of often like cooking or playing an instrument or something. It's a kind of rule of thumb, really, that you're often working with, or a kind of rough sense of what you think your imaginary reader might need.
That's really interesting to hear you say about the differences in opinion as to, you know, what constitutes a desirable explanatory note or something. Because I felt very much when I was editing A Clergyman's Daughter, being brought up very often against the limits of my own knowledge and thinking, now, is that just because I'm uninformed and I should know more? Or am I really sort of encountering something that is just fallen out of common understanding? And a lot of this was to do with biblical allusion. You know, I'm modern in that sense. My sense of biblical culture is limited, and I've had to do research in order to sort of figure out what's going on there, which has been very instructive. But of course, it then raises the question of, well, is that just my lack of familiarity with this material, or am I sort of trying to anticipate a reader who's too similar to myself in annotating something? So I mean, I think it's a really fascinating kind of quandary. One of the other things that the Oxford World's Classics don't require of editors is a sort of a very thorough, I mean, they encourage it, obviously, but it's not like it's a scholarly edition where you're sort of providing the defining, textually defining version, the sort of like the version of note of the text that you're actually editing for them. But nevertheless, many people will want to look into the textual history of these texts. And of course, 1984 is very interesting in this respect because we have sort of some of a manuscript, don't we? Did you look into that?
In a way, 1984 is relatively straightforward. So it's not like, you know, Homage to Catalonia, where there's revisions, for example. So because it comes out late in his life, you know, there's only one edition. Well, there's an American edition and a British edition in his lifetime. And the American edition is different, but it was clear that the UK edition had the priority. The good thing about I was doing all this in the middle of COVID lockdown, which meant I couldn't get to look at the proofs, which, you know, was just simply impossible. They're in UCL. But the manuscript, of course, is in a facsimile, and that was very useful to have. My sense was, compared to editing, say, a Dickens novel or a Trollope, on the footnotes, there were far fewer literary allusions. There was the Eliot one, there were some biblical ones. But usually when you're editing 19th century text, densely elusive kind of writing, whereas I think Orwell is trying to strip that out, I think, in 1984. It's not going for those kind of literary effects. And in terms of the text, it was relatively straightforward. I mean, the difficulty, the thing I found most difficult, like, so I worked from a first edition, and there were some typos and things in that, but on the whole, it was a pretty clean, well-done edition. The thing I found most difficult was rereading the torture scenes over and over again. I mean, I'd forgotten just how much this novel is about torture, like the whole last third of it. And in the middle of COVID lockdown, to have to read, you know, several times, you know, word by word, letter by letter, comma by comma, checking the text of that, you know, in various iterations, I was quite pleased when it was over. And I thought, okay, I don't need to read that again for a while.
It's very hard to make that known in the texture of an edition, isn't it? You know, the sort of the contextual factors that will influence the way it happens. I mean, I can see exactly what you mean. You know, at the best of times, it's difficult reading. But when things, you know, you're your sense of the world has shifted and things are different, you know, and we've been in this strange phase, very privileged relative to a lot of other people in the world, but nevertheless, you know, things have altered. It will make us read things in very different ways. And that scene is, I mean, that long sequence is just extremely difficult anyway. So no, I mean, I really sympathize with you there. I mean, I think that there's a power to it, which obviously comes through in the sort of reaction you're outlining. But I wondered just if we could, on this note, turn back to this remark that you were discussing a moment ago, namely the charge that the novel's characters are flat or lifeless in some way. And there's a quote from Orwell's contemporary, the modernist writer and painter Wyndham Lewis, who, in a very little known account of 1984, this is in a book called The Writer and the Absolute, he really sort of engages with Orwell as a thinker, a contemporary thinker of note in his view, but nevertheless one who's wrong and should be criticized. And he says that 1984 is Wellesian in form, Wellesian in the style of its writing, and then Wellesian in the colorlessness and anonymity of the personae. I just wondered what you made of that, because it's such a, I mean, it's, you know, it really leaves nothing to the imagination.
Exactly. And you think, well, that's probably a sign that it's wrong. Yeah, clearly Orwell is very interested in Wells. Wells isn't read as much as he used to be, but clearly he was an absolutely dominant figure. I mean, I think they ended up quarrelling in the end. But he's one figure of many. You know, we've already talked about Dickens. You know, Somerset Maugham is one. I think he says of all contemporary writers, he's the one he most admires. So there are many, as it were, figures feeding into Orwell's writing. And I think it sounds too defensive on Wyndham Lewis's part there. You know, it's so emphatic. You know, it's Wellesian in this, Wellesian in that. And of course, you know, as a critic or a thinker about a writer, you both want to recognise its depth. But also what you're interested in is how it's innovative or inventive or surprising or novel. So I think probably, you know, as it were, it's kind of trying to play the course with only one club, really, or it's doing the first half of it, but not the second half. So in a way, absolutely right. You want to recognize the Wellesian depths, but also just how different, just how different 1984 is. We couldn't imagine it being written by Wells. And I think the flatness of the persona isn't quite right, I don't think, because, you know, if you think of the opening, Winston, that he gets the journal, starts to write in it, and it's a very disturbing thing. He talks about going to the cinema and seeing a boat full of refugees being attacked from the air, and he finds it very exciting and interesting. Orwell doesn't create him as some kind of sensitive poet or heroic speaker of the truth. He's someone who Winston is already profoundly colonized by this terrifying society that he's part of. That's our first insight into his consciousness. And it's pretty complicated and weird, as are his feelings about Julia. He's deeply misogynistic. He has the sadistic fantasies. Yeah, he both wants to sleep with her and he wants to whip her like Saint Sebastian. So there come these queer sexual sadistic fantasies. That's not easy reading, and it is often deeply misogynistic, and particularly with working class characters and women characters, Orwell, you know, fails. You know. But in terms of Winston's psychological complexity, as somebody says about Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers, there's enough for a whole conference there.
A lot of what we've said about the novel is stressing its tensions or its failings, even, you know, the areas where it's just outright prejudiced or misogynistic, or, you know, in other ways not living up to ideals we would want to be lived up to, be they textual or political or ethical. Do you think that nevertheless, in spite of all that, there is an optimism in 1984? Because a lot of readers of the novel are keen to see it as optimistic in some way, either as a work of warning, which is what Orwell himself saw it as. You know, it's a work that warns about what's coming just around the corner. Or even more specifically than that, the ending, so with Winston's complete conversion to the love of Big Brother, which is then followed by this appendix, there's this critical tradition which has attached itself to the appendix in particular, and says that because of the grammatical phrasing of it, the fact that it's got a sort of past tense view, is that the future Orwell is outlining in the hypothetical future of his imagined world falls away, and that in that might be some sense that Orwell thinks ultimately these forces of totalitarian evil might actually be resistible if there's the will to do so. I realize that's a lot of questions all at once. But do you think, I mean, the central question is, do you think it's an optimistic work?
You know, you said about the question about whether it lives up to our ideals. I mean, I don't think literature should live up to our ideals. That's not the issue. And in fact, the bit I was criticizing Orwell for, the misogyny and so forth, I mean, that's also the most interesting bit of the book. That's where this particular structure of male desire and its interlocking with politics is most explicit in the book. You know, the very troubled way that we understand Winston's desires in relation both to the working class characters in the book and to women and to other men, that particular structure of homosocial desire in its relationship to politics is what gives the book its possibilities of, or its potential for insight. Yeah, that seems to me both the most troubled bit, but also the most interesting thing about the book. On the optimism, I don't know, in a way. I mean, the question about the appendix is, I think, really interesting. But perhaps for me, it's more of a formal question, as it were, than a kind of, than anything else. In the, you know, one of the ways it resembles a Gothic is the way that it emphasizes its, the strangeness of the text. You know, so the Gothics are full of discovered manuscripts and things and strange appendices, odd interpolations and found documents, all those sorts of things. And sure enough, this one does it too. It's both got the bit in the middle with Emmanuel Goldstein's tract on oligarchical capitalism and also the appendix. I mean, I think, you know, as it were, it's too easy to say, I mean, it's very suggestive, but it's too easy, I think, as Margaret Atwood has said, to say that this means that the place from which the appendix is written means that all that is over. That would be a very odd way of understanding the whole reading process of the text, as it were. You take it to this very dark place, and then suddenly you're allowed to infer that somehow, magically, in ways that were never shown or explained, it came to an end, having, you know, compulsively reiterated that it can't. So I think the interest of that is not that it gives you the optimism or the pessimism or that one trumps the other one, but it's precisely in the textual gap that the interest for us comes. The openness that comes from the temporal dislocation of the two times and the two speaking voices, as it were, of the main text and the appendix.
Yeah, I've always found that way of reading it tempting, but at the same time, it just doesn't seem to be sustained for me by, as you say, this sort of compulsively reiterated negativity and the sort of the denial of the possibility of an optimistic, you know, a repository of hope or some sort of other sense of spirited optimism that the book just time and again finds a way to counter or to destroy and annihilate. And it raises me a different kind of question it raises to me a different kind of question, which is namely, why is it that there are so many critics who seem to want to read it in that way? You know, why can't we just sort of sit with the negativity, as it were, and maybe learn something from that without there needing to be the hope? Maybe that hope will come from somewhere else, having read it and sort of sat with it for so long. This leads me to the question that I wanted to end our discussion with, which is the connection between the book and now, which is, I realize, is not a small topic. But I just wondered what you made of it, given that you are, of course, or that you have been editing this work at a time when it has become so newly popular, although not for the first time in its history, in relation to world events. How did that feel, working on 1984 against the background of things like fake news, alternative facts, and so forth?
In one way, I wanted to push back against too quick a connection between contemporary politics and the novel, because having read a lot of criticism from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on, in a way, I felt people were overeager to cast the novel in contemporary terms in ways that then dated their reading. And they did that in ways that the urgency of their current politics meant that they became careless readers of the book in ways that they weren't noticing all sorts of interesting and complex dimensions of it that often that led them to simplify the book or to kind of misunderstand it. So one thing the book is very interested in, and we just talked about it a minute ago, in the relationship between the main novel and the appendix, is temporality and conflicting kinds of temporality. So that the novel is very interested in memory and the past. The appendix, as it were, looks in some way to a future. And the way that those in a way in the book are never easily assimilable to each other. And I think that's important and necessary, that there's always a kind of contretemps. There's always a significant temporal difference there are significant temporal differences within the way that the book thinks about time. So I think that, as it were, the preface to thinking about how it might be in the present is to recognize that both that, in a sense, there is no present. There's always that any kind of, as it were, my present moment might not be your present moment, and that very present moment might be different moment later. So that there's the sense that you want Orwell's work somehow to coincide with the present as you currently conceive it seems to be very deep within criticism, but also quite a misleading thing to want to do. And you can see that in practical terms, the way that the sheer range of people from far right to far left who have appropriated one or another aspect of Orwell's book. So those are all the cautions, as it were, that I want to say. And that's a caution about oversimplifying the text to cache it too quickly and not recognizing the complexities of issues about time and temporality, both in the novel and in any thinking of the contemporary politics to a literary text. Having said all that, I do think the interest in surveillance capitalism does seem to me to speak to something very deep in the novel. So that the humble little telescreen that can constantly watch you and with which you can interact really on the whole hasn't been talked about very much in the criticism. Of course, in the kind of world that our desires and needs and activities are constantly being observed through mechanisms of surveillance in through the internet and through iPads and through emails and through forms of social and digital marketing and so on and so forth. That does seem to me to in a way be the, if you have to say, where the cutting edge of the book is in terms of thinking about politics now. That power of surveillance is now, has powers undreamed of. The modern state and modern capitalism has powers absolutely undreamed of by the thought police. And that for me is one key node of reflection.
I agree. I mean, I think the challenge now is to find ways of reading, if you're so inclined, to find ways of reading Orwell and 1984 that see its pastness in a sense, that see it as a product of its time and yet see the relevance at the same time. Holding those two things in play simultaneously seems to me very difficult. But necessary if we're to get past the thought that, it predicted everything, which is in some journalistic accounts, it can sometimes seem, that's the way it's being thought of. This is the book that imagined our future and we'll never need another guide again. But
that's often a kind of sock puppeting, I think, in which people, by squinting at Orwell and being very selective about what they choose, they can then tell you what they think. Just on the time point. I mean, it's a deeply dislocated novel from the start. It's written in the late 40s, but it's a cast into the future, which is now a past. So there's a dislocation of time, both in Winston's work, the whole conception of the novel, in the relationship between the appendix and the main text. And for me, the starting point of any thinking about how we might have it now, how we might relate to it now, is recognizing that profound set of dislocation of time and temporality that are there in the book.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about the book. I really appreciate it, John. Thank you.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for asking me. I mean, that was really interesting and stimulating, and I really enjoyed it. Thank you.